Good evening, Demon fans, and welcome back to the Demonland podcast. My name is Andy, and the Demons 2025 season cannot come to an end quickly enough. It's been a year of frustration, setbacks, and what feels like an endless limbo for the club. Interim coach, interim president, interim CEO, no home base, and the same on-field issues repeating week after week. Supporters are tired, the players look tired, and honestly, so am I. Joining me tonight to discuss another loss, our 27th out of the last 45 games, it's B-Man. Good evening, B-Man.
Good evening, Andy. Good evening, Demonlanders. Good evening to even the non-Demonlanders who are out there, the Hawks fans who might be listening tonight to revel in their victory.
You'd have to. It's a next-level troll to be wanting to come on and listen to.
Yeah, that was my thought, was exactly what you touched on, is are we there yet? It's like one more. We've got our grand final. Eddie was right. We've got our grand final this week. So, like, you never, except for the fact we won't get any gate from it. So, you know, don't turn up, D's fans. We don't want.
Yeah, I was going to say, a win is almost us not turning up and not giving them the gate.
Well, a win is no D's fans turning up. We win, they get no money, and they don't finish top four.
Well, that's why. It would have been so sweet if they were could fall out of the top eight. That would have been even nicer, but
Well, there's a question later, which is your position in a very good spot by Doug Reamer about our chances of winning, and I've got plenty of reasons why I think that we could win this game. And
of course you do.
Actually think that I reckon we're a good show this week. So,
well, that would be certainly be nice. So let's get into some housekeeping, because I do ask each week, I do ask our loyal listeners to support the podcast and leave us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts. It helps boost the podcast, and we truly appreciate that feedback. And as a token of our appreciation, we give them a shout out on the show. And Cornsy writes, thanks, guys, for a great podcast. I love your lighthearted yet factual in-depth analysis. I listened to Bigman's review of the West Coast game with a sinking heart after hearing about Goodwin's sacking. I agree that there were very positive signs for us to see about the game plan evolving. I think Goody has had so many challenges that have been beyond his control, e.g. losing Brayshaw, Clary's issues, Track's accidental injury, Joel Smith, etc., etc. Brad Green kept saying he's a terrific coach, so we have to find a better terrific coach. I, for one, am a Goodwin fan. Geez, it's been only 4 years since he won us a premiership. Goody deserve better than this. Norm Smith must be turning in his grave. I think the club has made a $1 million mistake. I am praying I'm mistaken. Thanks for the feedback, Cornsy, and you did find a loophole to get in a question or a comment on the show by giving us that 5-star review. So very much appreciated. Thank you.
And picking up Cornsy's point, I think going back to I think it's a really good point, like in terms of, you know, in addition to the instability that he had to endure as senior coach, Goody, I mean, in addition to that, is as Cornsy rightfully notes, you know, Clary's.
Hope it's not Kane Corns.
Yeah, Clary's stuff. You know, Track being out for half of last season with that and not being quite the player since, you know, that should be noted that that injury, it just seems like psychologically he's still far from getting over that. You mentioned Joel Smith, who it's easy to forget he was our best forward last year. Maybe it was because of his assistance.
Not last year, the year.
The year before, that, I should say. It's all blurring into to one. So he was our best forward at the end of the 23 season. So there's that. But it's a really good point about Brayshaw. I was thinking exactly that the other day, not so much about, well, it's true that Goody was unlucky that that happened, but I was really thinking that I just don't think you can underestimate the impact of losing Gus. You know, on field, we haven't really had a player, and maybe Rivers will become that player. We haven't really had a player who has got the license to position himself, you know, where he wants to, like the old-fashioned utility. And Gus was so good at, you know, even when he was playing in the midfield in his last two seasons, when he wasn't playing in a halfback flank, he often dropped back into the, and played a halfback role and pushed up to a defensive side of stoppages. He was doing that even when he was a halfback flanker. And so we haven't had that sort of player. I reckon Rivs could be that sort of player. So we've lost that. We've also lost his on-field leadership. You know, we've bemoaned our lack of leadership in the last two seasons, and I think it's a real issue, absolute real issue. And so, we've really missed that. That's been compounded, I think, this year by Nibbler not being there, who was probably, after Gus, our best on-field leader and our best on-field, well, apart from Max, I should say, best on-field leader outside of Max, who hasn't been there all season. And then I think the other thing with Gus, too, is that he was a glue type of person that sort of maybe connected the different groups, the younger players and the older players. And so I don't know that there's a natural sort of replacement for him. You know, maybe it takes time for someone to come up. But I think sliding doors moment is what I was thinking about. If I reckon we win that game against the Pies, if not for that injury, and then who knows, maybe we would have been in the box seat to win the flag that year, and Goody would be two-time premiership favourite and no one would be discussing sacking him. So, yeah, Cornsey's spot on is that he faced a number, you know, not to say that he didn't have – not to say he couldn't have improved as a coach in certain areas, but he certainly faced a lot of challenges that were well and truly outside his control.
All right, keep that feedback coming. Leave us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts, and we'll give you a shout-out on the show, and you can sneak in a little sneaky question in there if you want. Make sure to give us a follow on social media, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Also, you can watch and listen to the podcast on YouTube. Download the podcast at the usual places, Apple, Google, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcasting apps. If you want to connect with other passionate D's fans, come on over to our forum, demonland.com. It's free. Sign up, join in the conversation. If you want to call into the show live, head on over to demonland.com. If you're listening to this live, hit the call button. It'll take you to Microsoft Teams, just a link in your browser. You won't need to download any software. I'll answer your call, bring you on when there is a break in the conversation. If you want to listen to us live, one more show for the year, maybe another one a bit later just to wrap it all up with the trade week and on the draft a bit later in the year. So only a couple more to go. And we'll just get started off with this. Supreme Demon says, it's okay if you want to cancel this week's show. I wouldn't blame you, but if you do want to go ahead, then a fiery and angry rant is always appreciated. I find them therapeutic. So, be mad, I often hear people say how therapeutic and cathartic this podcast is for the listeners. It's almost like a group therapy session each week. But if I'm being honest, over the last 2 years, it's felt more like dread than therapy for me turning up to record this each week, week after week. Reliving the frustrations and disappointment hasn't exactly been fun. At this point, I reckon we should be charging people who listen to this for our service, basically running a free counselling session for the entire Demonland community. But on a serious note, and I'll be honest with you all, I was genuinely contemplating not doing the podcast at all this week at this stage of the season with, as I mentioned in the intro, with an interim coach, an interim president, interim CEO, entire club just seemingly seems like it's in a holding pattern waiting for a reset. And I feel like I've all but checked out and I don't even have the fire within me for a fiery and angry rant. I watched the game sort of half distracted, semi-detached and without much emotional investment. Just like the players in the club, I feel like I'm going through the motions waiting for a new coach, a new direction and hopefully a new sense of hope. And to be frank, as I said as well, season just cannot come end soon enough. And as I was going through the list of questions, it really struck me how many of the issues being raised are the same ones that we've been circling back to again and again this year. And it's not a criticism of the questions. I deeply appreciate every single listener who takes the time to submit them. They're an essential part of what makes this podcast work. And the questions give us a framework and highlight the issues that are on the supporters' minds and keep the conversation anchored in what the fan base is truly feeling. And we couldn't do the podcast without that input. Well, technically we could, but it would lack the same authenticity of the connection with the audience. And the truth is, though, right now the club feels like it's in limbo and the topics feel repetitive, like Groundhog Day. And it's draining trying to unpack the same frustrations week in, week out, where nothing seems to change. And to add to the fact that I'm also dealing with a couple of personal challenges off air that are leaving me like physically and emotionally spent. And I'll admit I'm running on fumes at the moment. I'm burnt out, flat, seriously considering putting the queue in the rack for the remainder of the season. But this thing, out of respect for our listeners and out of respect for my co-host, where we're going to push on, might be a shorter format this week. We'll still cover the essentials. I'll take you through a match overview. Big Man's going to bring you his stats. And I'll put the listener questions. I've sort of just sort of shortened them a little bit just to keep them a bit more brief this week, and I'll get Big Man to respond to them. I'll keep them trimmed down to allow for, you know, just to go a bit quicker. We'll touch on the AFLW, the Casey game, go over the changes and do a quick preview of the Collingwood match. And I do want to apologise for cutting back on the questions this week. I know how much time and thought goes into them, and I just wish I had the energy to give them the full justice they deserve. But please know, I'm incredibly grateful for your ongoing support and contributions, even if I can't cover everything in the way that I normally do. Thanks again for sticking with us. It's more that it means more than I can put into words. So I'm going to get into the match overview very quickly. Melbourne's inconsistent season hit another low on Saturday evening as they slumped to a 36-point defeat against Hawthorn. The loss echoed the round 9 clash with the Hawks, another game where we were comprehensively beaten, but this time without the competitiveness or energy that had briefly defined the mid-year resurgence that we had. The Demons went into the match amid speculation about their next senior coach and with an opportunity to redeem themselves after a rocky second half of the season. Instead, they produced a performance lacking intensity, structure and forward connection, leaving the club and its supporters with more questions and answers heading into 2026. The game began with a moment that summed up Melbourne's fortunes. Just 45 seconds in, Dylan Moore's snapped goal for Hawthorn was upheld despite clear signs that Trent Rivers had touched the ball. Even Moore himself gestured for a kick-in, but the score review ruled in the Hawks' favour. It was another controversial decision the AFL may be forced to address, but more importantly, it set the tone for a disastrous first quarter. By quarter time, the Hawks had slammed on 5-3 to Melbourne's solitary goal, with Jack Dunstan tormenting Stephen May en route to a 7-goal haul. The Demons' backline looked overwhelmed. Their midfield couldn't gain traction at stoppages, and their ball movement was stagnant. Melbourne's inability to score efficiently was glaring. From 56 inside 50 entries, they managed just 8 goals, a conversion rate far below Hawthorn's 13 goals from 49 entries. For a team that had been averaging 92 points since the mid-season bye, their return of just 56, inflated by 3 late goals in junk time, underlined the collapse in connection between midfield and attack. The midfield of Clayton Oliver, Christian Petrarca and Jack Viney were named among the best, but tellingly none reached their peak influence. Oliver had moments of class, Petrarca found some rhythm linking up inside 50, and Viney fought hard at the contest, yet Melbourne was consistently monstered at stoppages. Even when the senior leader stood tall, they lacked support and cohesion around them. The forward line continued to be a source of frustration. Jacob Van Ruin and Harrison Petty managed 2 goals apiece, but their opportunities were sparse and rarely came from clean delivery. Cozzy Pickett, Jake Melksham, who was subbed at halftime, and others were peripheral for much of the match. If there was one constant shining through the gloom, it was Captain Max Gawn. In another All-Australian caliber performance, he finished with 27 disposals, 36 hit-outs, 6 marks and 5 clearances. Beyond the numbers, he continually dropped back to cover defensive holes as Hawthorn surged forward. His leadership and work ethic remained exemplary, but it was a lonely stand with too little support from teammates. The most concerning aspect for Melbourne was their defensive vulnerability. Stephen May's 250th game was one to forget, as Gunston routinely outmanoeuvred him in one-on-one contests. Blake Howes was later sent to try to stem the damage, but fared no better. With Jake Lever absent, Melbourne's defensive structures looked shaky and easily exposed, highlighting a lack of balance that has become more apparent as the season has dragged on. This game was more than just another loss. It was a stark reminder of Melbourne's regression in 2025. Earlier in the year, they had shown glimpses of resurgence, beating both of last year's grand finalists and pushing Collingwood to the brink on King's birthday. For younger players, the late season fade might be explained by fatigue, but for the club's senior leaders, who are still among the best yet below their peak, it sends a message to whoever takes charge as coach next season that systematic change is needed. the late flurry of goals only served to flatter the margin. In truth, this was a sobering reminder of how far Melbourne has slipped since their 2021 premiership and how much work lies ahead for the club's next coach. Big man, your stats files.
It's interesting perception, such an interesting thing. And I was just saying before we started, I was like watching the game. So, you know, I actually thought our effort was really good. And you know, I thought there was quite actually a fair bit to like about the game. So I was a bit surprised when I did read Demon Land how negative people were about our performance. And, you know, to be honest, it mirrored your review there, because watching live, I thought, well, you know, a couple of things. One, they jumped out of the box and they were just clearly on, and clearly had a game plan, which, I mean, I guess your expectations frame it a little bit. I said last week that I thought we'd really struggle, that our only chance of winning is that if we start hot and that we stop their ability to get it to the outside, and they just killed us because they got it to the outside. And but the reality is that, you know, once again, it was one quarter. We scored 7 goals after quarter time to their 8 goals. So really the damage was done in that first quarter. So I'll unpack that a little bit more in a sec after I do the player ratings. You mentioned the senior players. You know, you can't really knock them. Once again, our best player on the ground, yeah, must be some sort of record. Okay, for the season wrap-up, I'm going to do the research and find out what the records are. But another best on-ground performance by Max Gawn for us, best Melbourne player, I should say, with 17.5 points, incredible number of games this year that he's been our highest-rated player. Clayton Oliver, you mentioned that he didn't have a great game, or maybe I misinterpreted what you said, but he was our second highest rated player, 16.4.
Now, what I was alluding to is that these guys were in our best, but they were well below their output. They didn't have the impact that you would sort of expect from our best players.
Well, so I'm not saying interesting. You can debate all day. We're our better player. You can debate all day with the pearls of the world about, well, let's believe what our eyes tell me. So what my eyes told me in watching the game is that I thought we actually performed quite well after quarter time. We were defensively woeful in the first quarter, and I'll unpack that a bit in a minute. But they were awesome. They were switched on and they, you know, they pulled us apart. There's some big questions that we'll get into a little bit. I'm surprised there wasn't a question about it. Like, what was Chaplin doing? One, putting May on Gunston. He was never going to be quick enough. Two, why did he leave him on him so long? And three, he picked Howes, not Disco Turner, to go to him. You know, Howes was unbelievably loose on him, I thought. But May was, he looked cooked. So, well, you know, I think, but after quarter time, as I said, 7-8 after that against the top four side. And just on that, like you're saying, and again, this is where stats are useful, is that, you know, the player ratings is all about scoreboard impact. And, you know, you could argue that it doesn't necessarily, you know, isn't such a good rating, but I think it is the most reliable indicator, you know, rating there is. And in terms of impact, I made a point last week about actually that we didn't perform that well. We were flat a little bit last week by our accuracy. This week we were inaccuracy back to our bad ways. Maxi was our highest rated player, I noted last week, but then there was a big drop off to our second player, who was only 13. And, you know, our top five was 13s and 12s. Clayton Oliver was our second highest rater, 16.4, so 3 points clear of whoever was second last week. Christian Salem had his best game for the season, 16.1, 3 points clear, easily a bit more than 3 points of the third player last year. Remember, player ratings is specifically the impact on the scoreboard for these players. Jacob Ranruen had a remarkable last quarter, a remarkable 14.5, but otherwise he went 0.8, minus 1.6, 0.4, but he went to town and had a great last quarter. So you could, you know, deride them as junk time goals, but his effort was terrific. And he was our fifth highest rated player, 14.1. And then you got Jack Viney, 6, and Tom Sparrow, 7. worth noting, Jai Cully had another good game, 12.5. So of the top six players, seven players, if you count Sparrow, which you should, a senior player, six of them were our senior players and all rated pretty well compared to last week. So we're better than our rating points were better last week. It fell away. Cozzy had another average game, 8.6. Stephen May had 3.7.4 in that first quarter, but he looked miles off it, I thought. Disco Turner had his worst game for some time, 1.9 for the game. Ed Langdon continued that theme that I mentioned last week. It's a real concern. He's fallen away in this back half of the season. He had scored a grand point of a total of zero player rating points. And Harry Sharp, again, had another less than sharp game. He was negative 4.1 from 71% game time. So, yeah, so, you know, I think our senior players worked hard. It was great to have Rui have a good last quarter. Just before I go on to the – so the, I don't think there's you know, – I've been structuring it up like how we could have won or and why we didn't win. So not this week because I don't think we were ever going to win that game. I talked about it last week, and I forgot to mention last week a bit of an oversight of mine that it was six-day break to nine-day break, massive advantage, like a huge advantage to Hawks, a significant advantage to them, particularly given you know, we're a young player, that a team or a relatively young team with a what I think is a very low fitness base or not enough of a strong fitness base. So they're coming good, Hawks, like I mentioned last year. I think they're a good chance of winning the flag, to be honest. They really played smart in this game. Just before I go on to the good and the bad and the ugly, just an apology, Andy, really, to you last week. I noted that I don't often, if ever, listen to back to the podcast and listen to the first 20 minutes of last week, and your summary of Goody's stuff was just first class, totally first class. It was really impressive listening. And I wanted to apologize. It's one of my lifelong irritating habits, as my friends and family would attest to, is interrupting. And so I noted that I did a fair chunk of interrupting you last week. So be better, bin man, and apologies for that. But I blame you because you're the MC.
Nah. You're allowed to talk. You're
so
allowed to talk.
Pull me up. Give me a whack when I interrupt you. So back to the stats files. So good. Look, as I said, we were beaten by a much better team. I think they're a real chance of winning the flag. They've got a game plan and players that expose our key weaknesses. So we match up really poorly against them, namely our propensity to turn the ball over, which has been a shocking trend all season, in the last 3 years, to be honest. Our real difficulty defending turnover, our woeful center square and around the ground stoppage structures, and our suboptimal aerobic fitness, leg speed and running power. I think they really exposed all of those things. And right from the get-go, they looked to exploit it by spreading the ground wide. The commentators noted it on the replay. They really spread that ground to deliberately spread our defense. And, you know, we were really
poor. And as well, particularly early, they were playing on every opportunity they could get, a quick handball out.
Yeah, absolutely. And looking to stretch the ground, make the ground big. And that's all about, the Saints did that to us in the last quarter in the Alice. And that's all about knowing that your opposition is, one, not where they're at with their fitness, two, is coming off a six-day break to a nine-day break.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, I thought our effort wasn't so bad in the first quarter. It was just that we were blown off the park, but our defensively were terrible. And in particular, our all-team defense was terrible. And we were down almost five goals at quarter time break. So, you know, it has to be said, poor first quarters has been really, really big trend this season. And so there must be something we're not getting right with our preparation. And that's where you can fairly put that on Goody. And in this case, Chaplin. But it's, you know, it's been an issue all season, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So before the Ruse-Goody era, that's what I was thinking about this match, is why. So, you know, it was a very dispiriting first quarter. For me, it was way, way more about how well Hawks played than how poor we were. Before the Ruse-Goody era, that game, with all of the things that I just said in terms of that we're not matching up well against them, the first, you know, being down five goals the first quarter, at the end of the first quarter, that was the perfect recipe for a, you know, in times gone past, that's a 10 plus goal blowout, you know. But, you know, the end of a disappointing season, the butt end of a disappointing season, young players are tired, our key defender, May, is completely cooked. I don't think he should have played. The second game after the dead cat sack coach bounce, a 6 to 9 day break, as I mentioned, coming up against a team sharpening their talons for finals, who 100% came to play, and you know their pressure in the first quarter was formidable. We just couldn't go with them. So as I say, you know, normally that would be a recipe for a 10 plus goal blowout in history. So I was really impressed that they fought the game out and right to the final siren. Personally, watching the game, I thought after our first quarter, and even in that first quarter, our effort and spirit was really, really good. It was reasonable, as I said, in the first quarter. It was more that our skills were terrible and our defensive structures were a complete mess. So I reckon big kudos to the boys for playing the game right out and not dropping their head. And so that's what you want to see from a team that is, you know, bottom four team. If people argue that we're bottom four and we're playing a top four team, I mean, seriously, what do people expect? So the stats most relevant to assessing, and this is goes to this point about effort. So the coaches, when they look at what intent and effort, they looked for contest, tackles, and pressure. And so those stats completely support my sense watching the game live that our effort was actually really good. And also that the Hawks didn't drop their effort all game. So they didn't put the cue in the rack in that last quarter, despite what some might say. So, you know, to evidence that, we were plus one for contested possessions in this game, 143 to 142. That doesn't speak to a team that's checked out. Plus seven for post-clearance ground ball gets, 71 to 64. Plus 13 for tackles, 68 to 55. You know, we were chasing tail for much of the day, so there's a little bit of an asterisk on that. But nonetheless, the plus 13 for tackles speaks to effort. And pressure of our average pressure for the entire match was 183. That would be in our top six or seven for the season. By way of contrast, last week in a game that people seemed to be thrilled with, and I was less so about our performance, our pressure rating was 171 versus the Dogs and 183 against the Eagles. So, you know, I thought it was a commendable effort. Our team pressure in that first quarter was 173. Which is 180s AFL average. So, you know, keep in mind we've had quarters where we're in the 150s for our pressure rating. So 173 is not a nightmare. The difference was they were 203 for that quarter. 203, so a differential of 30 pressure points, and it really showed. That's what I mean. They came to play and blew us off the park. We couldn't go with them, and as I said, again, they're a top four team, we're a bottom four team, so I don't know, you know, it's hardly surprising. But what was admirable was from that point on, we went plus 17 in the second quarter, 182 to 165, plus 8 in the third quarter, 187 to 179, and again, I'd be guessing, but our last quarter was 190 to 191. So they were 191, their second highest rated pressure for the game, the Hawks. So, but we were 190. And I would think, at a guess, there would be probably no more than three or four games all season that we've had a quarter four. Our fourth quarter has been 190 or more in the last quarter, maybe five tops. So it was ended up being almost split 183 to 184 for pressure. So the coaches would have been really happy with that because that's how they measure intent and willingness to fight and to be in the game. Funnily enough, our big issue all season has been turnover, and you might have thought it might be in this game because, geez, it felt like it. You know, some of our skill errors were terrible. We just dropping marks all game. It just felt some of the mistakes. But in fact, our turnover was below our season average. So we conceded 43. We scored 43. 43 points on turnover against a season average of 46, and we conceded 42. So they only scored 42 points on turnover. And for context, our season average is 48.2 we're conceding. So, in fact, we did better in this game than we have done for most of the season. And so not too bad on both fronts. So, as I said, 42 points from turnover, 43 that we scored ourselves. By way of comparison, we scored 59 points on turnover ourselves against the Dogs, but we conceded a whopping 67 points last week. So 15, about 25 points less than we coughed up to the Hawks. So, you know, when they're doing the match review, they would 100% focus in on that, because we've got to improve in that area. We're going to get killed if we don't reduce our turnover scores. So they were positive. The intent and contest and effort was 100% there. So it was good to see that the stats reinforce what my sense was watching the game. Bad, we were inaccurate again. Expected score was 65.2. We could only manage 56. Their expected score was 93.5. They managed 92. So on the expected score margin was only 18 points. No, what's that? 28 points, I should say. Downright ugly. So downright ugly. We were just terrible on transition. So really, really bad. And it felt like the commentary on Demonland and even in the game felt like if you just listened to the commentary, you would think that, that they were crazy good. That Hawks were amazing on transition, they just killed us on transition. We were terrible, so they did kill us on transition. But so chain to scoring, these are the transition stats that help people understand how well teams move the ball from the back half. Chain to score percentage, we were 12.8% of the time, they were 20.6, but the AFL average is 20.6. Defensive 50 to forward 50 percentage, we were 7.1, which just tells us how poorly we move the ball, minus 20%. They were 27.3, above the season AFL average, but not much. That's 22.8, the season average. This one is barely believable. Defensive 50 to score percentages, we didn't score a point, zero. So 0% time we moved it from our back half to score of our plays, which is woeful. 9.1% of the time they did it. So against an AFL average of 9.6. Defensive half to forward half 50, which is the one they put a lot of stock on, 17.9% of the time we did that, from move the ball from our defensive half to forward half on transition. They did it 32% of the time against a season AFL average of 31. So again, my point being is, in fact, their transition wasn't crazy good. Excuse me, our transition was terrible. And then the last one, the big one really, defensive half to score percentage, we only managed 4.5% of the time when we chained it out of our defensive half. We could only score from 4.5% of those chains. They did it 14.1% of the time. So in all of those transition stats, they did smash us. But again, they see AFL average is only not 12.7 against their 14.1. So they didn't actually, it wasn't like they were unbelievable at transitioning the ball like everyone seemed to be suggesting. We were just terrible. So, but all of those stats add up to woeful number from our back half. We only scored 18 points in this match from our defensive half, which is a line through the middle of the ground, through the center. So that's the defensive half is on one side, the offensive half's on the other. We only scored 18 points. They scored 46 against we. So we concede 38.4 on average. So, again, not massively over our season average. Our season average four has been 29, and it's been about 35 in the last 6 or 7 weeks. We've been transitioning the ball really well, top five in the AFL for ball movement. 18 in this match against last week, by way of comparison, we scored 51 points from our defensive half last week. So we actually, funnily enough, as much as I said defense was really, we didn't defend transition. That was mainly in the first quarter. So we actually defended transition pretty well, because 46 points that they scored from their D50 is not too bad, particularly how many of those points, and I'm guessing at least 20 of those points were in the first quarter when Gunston was getting such good service from, fast ball movement. So, but in terms of ugly, I reckon this is just about the ugliest set of stats all season. So these are barely believable numbers. So just raw numbers of total clearances. We won the total clearance count 40 to 35. So plus 5 for total clearances. Center clearances were 15 to 7. So plus 8, we won 8 more center clearances than them. Stoppage clearances were almost the same, 25 to their 28. These are just the raw numbers of clearances. So minus 3. First possessions, we had 7 more first possessions than them from clearances, 45 to 38. And remarkably, first possession to clearance, we beat them in that stat. 71.1% of the time when we got the first possession after a clearance to their 68%. So remarkable, and AFL average is 74. So their first possession to clearance percentage was under AFL average, and so was ours, but we were just under. So we actually did brilliantly winning the clearances, quite remarkable set of numbers. But there's never a better example of why raw clearance numbers really aren't, you know, they're by the by. Yes, they're good for territory and it's helpful to win them, and it was 50-50 again in this game in terms of time in forward half and defense. And but it's not about, you know, the raw clearance numbers. They're not the main game. It's scores from stoppage. And somehow we turned that positive set of numbers, so again, plus 5 in total number of clearances, plus 8 from center clearances, into we scored only 6 points from one goal, 6 from center bounce, plus 4. That's because they scored 2 points. So remarkably, there were only 8 points in this game from center clearances, and we only managed 6 despite winning 8 more clearances than them, and despite our high first possession clearance percentage. This was even worse, though. Like, well, this was the game right here. We only scored 13 points from stoppages in total, which is just unbelievable given our, you know, numerical advantage that I just mentioned. We only scored 7 points from around the ground stoppage to they scored 48. So we were minus 41, minus 37 in total from around the ground stoppages and centre bounces, but minus 41 from around the ground stoppages. That's just nuts. And I mean, it's barely believable. Like, I can't think there'd be any numbers like that for us all season. And I suspect that would be a pretty rare set of numbers for any club. That's a shellacking, and to me it really, again, shines the light on our setup and structures have just been all over the shop this season, I reckon. And, I suspect there will be changes in that regard.
Oh, you would think so. With a new coach coming in, you would hope that they've come up with some new ways to do things. All right, let's get into our listener questions. I have shortened some of the questions, so apologies. The context and everything, the meaning behind the questions are still there, but it's just about moving it on today. Just in regards to player positions and selections, what says, is the first half proof that trying Jake Bowie as a forward doesn't work? We had no one with a calm head behind the ball. Jackson Fix says, who would have done a better job today, Jed or May? Why aren't we trying new things and giving Casey players a chance instead of looking old, slow, and effortless? Just on the Casey thing, I would say that the club is now all in on Casey, given their finish to the year and their chance to perhaps go deep into September. So perhaps some of the Casey players that you've been screaming for won't get a chance to play. We'll talk more about changes a bit later. Bin Man, anything else on whether Jed Adams should have got a game or Jake Bowie playing as a forward initially and then moving back? And any other anomalies in the players that you saw playing out of position?
Well, in terms of what? I mean, I don't think it's proof that trying Bowie as a forward doesn't work, because I wouldn't mind a Bowie up forward and a Bowie down back, but I totally agree. In terms of our kicking out of the back half was terrible. Although, again, our turnover numbers were some of our best numbers. So it's funny, isn't it? I'll be really interested to see the All Australian squad and selection. Of course, I would have him in the All Australian, but
he's not going to be
often first time, as you know, often they get the squad is the first step. So I'll be very disappointed if he's not at very least in the squad, because he's just been a general back there. And I tell you what, we've needed his leadership back there. And, you know, so which goes to the question, who would have done a better job today, Jed Adams or May? It's pretty hard to argue that Jed Adams wouldn't have done a better job. I thought that was Steve May's one of his worst games for a very long time, and he looks cooked, and
he looks even checked out. I don't know if it could be a fitness thing, because he's missed a bit of footy now.
Well, he just seems to struggle to get down low, and then it was really perplexing. It was really perplexing while Chaplin left him on him, because it was evident right from the get go. And not only that, they were isolating May. That was their best transition quarter by far. And then after that, you know, so he wasn't helped by us not being able to stop that ball moving quickly and not being able to put enough pressure on the ball carrier. That's certainly the case. But he was caught behind a couple of times, you know, where he was just lacked the foot speed. But then when he was caught in front, the game started with him giving up that mark, which if it was any other player, like, you'd be going, what the, you know, he had front position and allowed Gunston to push him under the ball with not much effort and, you know, set up that first goal Gunston's first goal. It's like, geez, I just thought, you know, I just thought it was Jed Adams would have had the leg speed at least to go with Gunston. It was a really poor game from May. And I thought, really, if he was going to be that immobile, they shouldn't have played him. You know, I don't know whether I guess he'll play this next week. But I agree, in terms of why aren't we trying new things, I think they're all in on Casey, and so they should be. Like, it was a great, we'll talk about it. It was a really enjoyable game of footy to watch. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it as much as more than the seniors, in the sense that we won it. But, it's a real opportunity for those players to go deep into finals and potentially snag a flag. And, those players will bring that through their career at Melbourne, you know, players like Colt and Kentfield and Jefferson and AMW won't be there, but, you know, players like Cinema.
AMW might be there on grand final day this year.
Yeah, well, he might be, but how exciting was Cinema? Like, you know, so that was a really exciting game. Those players, if they can go deep into finals, I guess Cinema won't be eligible, but, you know, it makes total sense to go all in of that. Why, you know, chuck around the magnets? And besides which, you know, I want to beat Collingwood, you know, and I wanted Melbourne to give us a best chance that we had of beating Hawthorn. I didn't think we'd beat Hawthorn, and I mean, hardly, that's, you know, that's really groundbreaking, but I genuinely think we're a chance of beating Collingwood. So I hope they pick their very best team. And Casey, now I've got, I flicked over, it's really exciting because they said on the Casey coverage that Frankston were behind in the game against the Bears, was it? Yeah, the Lions, I should say. And
they drew in the
They end. Drew. Did so they, I watched the last few minutes, and a draw meant that we finished fifth and we avoid the wildcard weekend, get a week's rest. So if they'd lost that game, we would have finished sixth and been playing in the wildcard game. So that was quite exciting bit of old school VFL footy, being able to jump across from the Casey game to the Frankston game, which was played at Frankston Oval, which looks very much like a suburban VFL ground. So yeah, it was quite enjoyable to watch.
Sorry, a moment ago you said AMW, but I was thinking Nibbler for a second, right. And that's why I said well, Nibbler might be playing a premiership this year.
He might be a dual premiership player, I tell you. They're looking good.
He could be. All right, next one. D for Life says, are we fit enough? The Hawks ran us ragged. Do we need a new tackling coach, since they broke out of tackles easily? And are our sloppy skills down to a lack of confidence? Fab Demon says, the team has fallen off a cliff since 2024. Fitness has declined, younger players are stagnating, and many seniors outside of Gorn are underperforming. How does the panel see us reversing this slide? Howard Grimes says, Hawthorn showed the gap in skills, finesse and forward craft. Are we stuck playing a copy and paste game plan? How many senior players need to be moved on this offseason for the younger brigade to make a genuine impact? Travi14 says, did Chaplin revert to the old bombarding style against the Hawks? Why are our handballs so poor, tackling so weak and transition so non-existent when we turn it over? Pimmaster says, our forward craft let us down, spilled marks, poor separation, kicks to contest. Do we need instinctive forwards or at least a specialist forward coach? Spirit Norm Smith says, with no coach, no permanent president, no CEO, no home base, off-field dramas, retirements and two straight sets, finals exits, how did the 2021 premiership side unravel so quickly? Never Odd or Even says, who should be our leadership group next year? Is it time for a change of the guard? Red and Blue says, should we play to win every game, especially the milestones, or is it now the time to experiment with positions and roles? Is experimenting too much a motivation killer for the players? And these lot of questions was this sort of just there, what I was talking about, of the same old, same old. So if you want to take a couple of things, anything that catches your fancy from those questions, you don't have to go over all of it unless something in particular from there catches your eye.
Well, how about I'll tell you what, I'll go through bang, I'll do it like
smash
them through bang style. That, but just quickly, never odd nor or even on Demon Land, that's all one word. And I'm never,
I know, it's hard to say.
It's like, what do you call them?
It's hard to read.
Palogram or not a palogram. You know,
is it the same, the same backwards and?
Yeah, whatever.
What's that called?
It's not an interregnum, that's for sure. So, right, it's never odd or even, now I get it. Are we fit enough? No. Do we need a new tackling coach?
Palindrome.
It's his brother, isn't it? Isn't it his jiu-jitsu bloody brother?
Yeah, that's his brother. But I don't think that's a full-time thing. I think that probably did a session.
But that was frustrating. It has actually been a frustration all season. But I do wonder whether that's got something to do with how young our side is. Are our sloppy skills down to a lack of confidence? No, I think they just have got sloppy skills, most of our players.
How many times did we handball directly to one of them? I don't know what was going on then, but we handballed directly to them. I don't know.
How many marks did we drop?
Oh, a lot. And you know what? I thought maybe it was the weather, but they weren't having the same problems and, you know.
And what is – I mean, I tell you, I'm going to stick fat with Van Ruin, but Van Ruyen, I should say, but geez, his marking has just been terrible, hasn't it?
It must be confidence. I don't know what it is, because I've seen him take some fantastic marks. He's not getting anywhere near him at the moment.
He seems to be misjudging his run-up. I don't know, it's like, some of our skills. And I think one of the things that Goody was trying to do is really trying to implement a lot of high handball. And I think our handball skills are pretty woeful as well. So that really exposed us. Again, though, having said all of that, it was not a bad effort in terms of who we were playing and only giving up 45 points on turnover. That's better than our season average. So, sometimes it just felt like there were a lot of errors, and maybe they just didn't hurt us in the way that they could have. Fallen off a cliff since 24, fitness has declined. How does the panel see us reversing the slide? New coach turning some player over. Fitness, for me, a lot of it comes back to fitness. In footy these days, you're not even in the conversation unless you're elite fit. And what Goody did, as we talked about last week, or perhaps the week before, is that he brought fitness to another level in AFL footy, and now we're way behind the leaders in that space. So for me, that's almost the most important thing in terms of reversing the slide, and then everything else. Well, it'd be good to have a coach, and it'd be good if we had a settled, stable governance and executive. But so I think they're the key, to be honest, fitness and getting the governance right, and then a coach. Hawthorn, gap in skill, agree. Forward craft, totally agree. I'm not sure about what Howard Grimes mean by stuck playing a copy and paste game plan, but it is really interesting. I think that, you know, one thing that Mitchell did really, you know, was interesting about how he went about building their current game plan, which is one of the things I wanted to mention actually, is he came in 22. It's taken them 3 years now to fully get that game plan where it's instinctive, where they do those handballs like we did in 21, and there just is a player there. They just know, they've got their systems and set up so well drilled. But the question about, like, will the pendulum swing back to another type of game plan? You know, do we, you know, presumably next year it will still be all about transition and ball movement from the back half. But, you know, just I wonder what the next sort of evolution of the game is, because as was noted last week, is that game plan, that high transition game plan, was a reaction to Goodwin's hyper ultra defense. So, it'll be interesting to see where the game goes next.
The copy and paste was just reference to Chaplin is copy and pasting Goody's game plan that there's been.
Of course.
But what can you do with three games to go? There's not much you can do. Maybe if it was halfway during the year, he could have tweaked some things a bit more. But, there's only much you can do right
possibly,
at the end of the year, teaching a whole new thing.
Yeah, sorry. Come on, Bin Man, do better. What's Chaplin going to do? Like, he's not going to introduce a new game plan now, for God's sake, you know. What was interesting in this game, so that next question, did he revert it to the old bomb-it-in style against the Hawks? Why are our handballs so poor? I think our handballs are so poor because we're terrible at handballing. I agree with the tackling not being great. Our transition, so non-existent when we turn it over, that's just not the case. That's like, as I said in the numbers, our transition was actually, in this game it was terrible. It hasn't been all season. We're one of the best sides at transitioning the ball from the back half. That's just a fact. And so I'll get into that when why we can beat Collingwood, because we're much better than them than transitioning from the back half. We're top five. We're fifth in the AFL for ball movement. So did he revert to the old bombing inside? I don't think so. I just think that they really tactically had a good game. And as I said, they really looked to stretch us and we couldn't cover. The six-day break played a big factor in that. One of the things is that all-team defence is completely reliant on ability to spread and cover the spread. And we were paddling a bit, I thought. Sorry, you're going to say something,
Andy? No, I said this is 9-day versus six-day breaks coming up next, which we may as well get into now because some of the other stuff is pretty much the same, just going over the old stuff. So Wells 11 said, did the 9-day break for the Hawks versus our 6-day break play a role in the result? Go D says, shouldn't teams be able to handle 6-day breaks? That was in response to Wells 11. Titan Uranus, won't say the way he wants me to say it, it's frankly dumb to attempt to ignore the 9-day versus 6-day break. Is clearly capable of being a factor, particularly for a side like us, which appears to me to have struggled with aerobic fitness all year. But then, of course, you see Adelaide have no discernible fitness issue against Collingwood, despite the exact same 9-day versus 6-day break issue. Fitness and the 3-day break difference cannot and does not explain everything. So, Bimman, I know that you're on the side of that it does have an effect.
It absolutely has an effect, and it did in that Collingwood game, by the way. The Crows looked flat. They almost got beaten by a team that's, lost now five of their last six games
Five of six, yeah.
So Adelaide are on top of the ladder, playing at home, and just get over the top of Collingwood, and Collingwood had something like 15 or 20 more inside 50s. They should have won that game. It absolutely had a big factor. It was a big factor in that Collingwood Crows game. It was absolutely a big factor in this game. There's no question about it. I mean, it just would absurd to think it wouldn't be a factor, particularly given we're coming off a much lower fitness base. Now, of course, you could set up your, just like we did last season when we beat Port after being in and staying in Adelaide and with a 5-day break. Remember, you could structure around it and to not do any training or whatever to overcome that, and Crows obviously did, but it had a demonstrable impact in the Crows Collingwood game, and it had a demonstrable impact in this game, which is part of the reason why I thought our effort was a lot better than people are giving it credit for, as evidenced by the, you know, our pressure rating being a 183 for the match. So they 100% also looked to exacerbate it by stretching the ground so wide and really trying to make us chase tail. Part of that is because they know they're fitter than us, but part of it is also because they know that we've got a 6-day break. So that was clearly a strategy. It's just absurd to think it's not a factor. You know, it's not an excuse either, but it's a factor, just like May being underdone and playing poorly is a factor. It's a factor just like our stoppage structures being woeful and us not being able to take advantage of how many clearances we actually won and turn them into scores. It's a factor like the weather. It's a factor that, yeah, it's just ridiculous not to expect that it has an impact. So, yeah, 100% it had a factor. Just back to who in the leadership group, I think that I just was thinking about that question. I do wonder, maybe not changing the guard, but I think it's really telling that Track is nominally our best player outside of Maxi Gawn. He's not seemingly been anywhere near the leadership group for a long time, has he, in terms of I think that's, you know, when you think of the club's best players like Dangerfield, or you think often they're also the best leaders. So I'm not sure if, you know, who, that's a question maybe for the end of the year, and you know, I think we should play to win every game, blue and red. I think we should play to win all the time and not experiment. Each game is worth winning. Just on Stephen May, I wonder why they played him, and someone made a comment that perhaps to ensure that he didn't get injured or something, and he was able to play his 250th, then maybe that's a factor. And so as much as I'm giving Maisie a hard time for his game, it shouldn't be gone. You know, we should credit him for 250 games and being, you know, absolutely, for Melbourne Footy Club, of course.
Absolutely. I'm going to skip the next question. Doomsday D, Roastar, talking about end of season player movements and attracting new players. I think that's best left to the end of the season. One more game to go, guys, and we can discuss that stuff. Let's get on to the AFLW. Did you see any of that? I've got a bit of a
summary. I did, yeah.
Of yep. That. Okay, so Melbourne opened their 10th AFLW season in emphatic fashion with a commanding 48-point victory over the Western Bulldogs at Witten Oval. The win not only saw the Demons retain the Hampson-Hardiman Cup, but it also marked a statement performance that showed their depth, class and trademark pressure game. After a tense opening quarter where both sides struggled to move the ball cleanly, the Demons clicked into gear in the second term with a four-goal blitz that broke the game open. From there, they controlled proceedings, piling on 7 of the last 8 goals and never allowing the Bulldogs back into the contest. The heart of Melbourne's dominance was their midfield, where Tyler Hanks and Liv Purcell were simply outstanding. Tyler Hanks was everywhere, finishing with 29 disposals and 2 goals, including a brilliant solo effort from a stoppage that iced the game. Her ability to impact both inside and outside the contest highlighted her standing as one of the league's elite midfielders. Liv Purcell was equally influential with 33 disposals, 7 clearances and a goal, driving Melbourne forward with her clean hands and relentless work rate. Supporting them was Shelley Heath, who produced a career-best performance with 23 disposals and constant drive, while Paxi Paxman and Eliza McNamara added further run and pressure. The midfield mix gave Melbourne balance and options all night. Captain Kate Hoare was lively, kicking 2 goals from 17 disposals and alternating between deep forward and midfield roles. Her presence caused constant headaches for the Bulldogs' defence. With Taylor Harris forced out at halftime after a freak eye injury, Eden Zanker took charge of the forward line, finishing with 2 goals and several crucial involvements. Alyssa Bannon chipped in with 1, and Hanks and Purcell's scoreboard contributions made Melbourne's attack multidimensional. Harris's brief cameo still had a big impact. Her soaring contested mark in the second quarter reminded fans what they missed last year during her long injury layoff. Though her night was cut short, her ability to draw defenders freed up space for Hoare, Zanker and Bannon. The Demons' transition from defence to attack was a highlight. Maeve Chaplin set the tone with her intercept work and willingness to take the game on. She gathered 14 disposals and 8 intercepts, helping Melbourne rebound with speed and intent. Irish recruit Blathan Macken provided run and composure in her return to the side, while the backline as a unit stifled the Bulldogs' forward entries. The Dogs managed just 1 goal for the match, courtesy of Heidi Woodley, as Melbourne's defensive pressure forced rushed and ineffective kicks inside 50. Melbourne's debutante slotted in seamlessly and added freshness to the lineup. Molly O'Hare, impressed with her pace and physicality. Maggie Marnie brought forward pressure and nearly moments that hinted at a potential, backed by loud support in the crowd. Layla Ebert was calm in and assured in defence, using the ball well under pressure. Their performance showed that the Demons list continues to develop depth and talent. Coach Mick Stanier praised his side's composure and adaptability, particularly after Harris's injury. He singled out the midfield balance and Chaplin's defensive leadership, noting that the D's ability to reset after halftime and dominate the contest spoke volumes about their maturity. With the win, Melbourne signalled that they remain genuine flag contenders in Season 10. Their midfield depth, forward versatility and defensive organisation were all on show in this polished display. Next up, the Demons host St Kilda at Casey Fields, aiming to make it 2 from 2 and continue building momentum early in the season. So, B-Man, what are your thoughts on the game?
It was an entertaining second half. It was a pretty obviously low-scoring first half. The Dogs looked a bit, you know, miles off it, really, I have to say. But we looked like a team. They mentioned it a number of times on the telecast that had played together for a long time, and that fast ball movement. It did make me wonder whether that style, I really like it. It's like what we want the men to be playing, that handball move. It. There was an end-to-end goal, which I don't know if you just mentioned then, but it was a terrific end-to-end goal, really. It was the classic sort of Melbourne women's team ball movement, you know, aggressive through the middle, good hands, multiple handballs, chains, and ended up in a nice goal. The question for me is, Will we have the physicality to go up against the Lions and the North Melbournes and the Crows again? That's where we've seemingly been caught out. Yeah. I mean, we've had injuries as well, of course, but it was a great start, big percentage booster. I wrote on Demonland that Hanks is right up there with Coz, and Max is my favourite Demon player. Just way she goes about a footy, so clever, and she's got such good footy IQ. She reads the ball well. She's one of those players like Coz that I like watching at stoppages, just to see, you know, her end up with the ball and how she positions herself to get the ball. And it was a pity I not able to go. And again, you know, I think the AFL have really got to get there. You know, it'd be great if they really focused on AFLW in a different way. It just made no sense to play that game at 7:30 on a Saturday night. Why not play the men's game at 1 o'clock? And then you would have had D's fans who went to the men's game go to the women's game. And, you know, they might argue, well, it's a TV thing and they could get home. And the main thing is the two replay or the two shows didn't clash on television. But, you know, the more people at the ground, the more atmosphere there is, and it also would cut against the ridiculous narrative that I'm finding really irritating about that AFLW's becoming less popular. You know, support the game, make sure there's every chance for D's fans to get there and have a crowd of 5,000-6,000. That's what we've had in previous openers. So, yeah, I think the AFL.
I think they made a big mistake with the AFLW. Not for the first few years, they really should have tried as many as possible to play as many games as possible prior to the men's game. So have it at the same, and I know there are issues with grounds and I don't want to play too many games on the grounds, but that would have been the best way to get people into AFLW, because just like the old days when you used to watch the Rezzies, you'd turn up at halftime or three-quarter time or sometime during the third quarter and you'd watch it, and that's how you get people into it, you know, and they'd get excited about it. Maybe they'd come a bit earlier the next week, and then have it as a standalone thing if you want, but they've really got to, and having it a clash of the same, you know, I heard that our cheer squad, half of them or all of them left at half time to go to the women's game or something.
It's just ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, that's a great idea. Why not have them, you know, they could, you know, put a man
and
on
not every game, but play us, if they're going to go with three rounds to go, play them all, but make Melbourne play Hawthorne this week or whatever, play us with the Bulldogs last week. Try and line them up so you get people and kids get excited about it because they're there and they'll see it, you know.
Yeah. Totally. I'm old enough to remember going to games and watching the under-19s and the Rezzies. Well,
you got there early.
and then the main game. So, you know, I mean, back in the day, there was a year when Richmond had Roach in the seniors, Brian Taylor in the reserves, and am I thinking right, and Jackson in the under-19s. That doesn't sound right, but they had an amazing lineup of full forwards, and that would make perfect sense. But at the very least, why not have, you know, make it a 1 o'clock men's game and then have the night game? And then so plenty of D's fans would have gone across from the MCG and watched the women's game. So I just think, you know, and they should got to stop playing games at Casey for the women's game, because it's just ridiculous. They should be playing them all at Icon Park or Witten Oval looks in great, Nick, play them there. And, you know, give the game the best possible opportunity to take out the variables as much as possible, like weather and all of those sorts of things, to, you know, to give it a really its proper opportunity to thrive.
Let's get into the KC game. The KC Demons capped off their roller coaster regular season with a statement win, toppling ladder leaders Box Hill by 23 points at KC Fields. The victory was more than just a morale boost. It propelled the Demons out of the precarious wild card zone and into a secure fifth place on the ladder, earning them the luxury of a week off before finals. It was a fitting conclusion to a remarkable turnaround. After languishing as low as 17th, I think out of 21, earlier in the year, Casey strung together a late season surge that saw them overtake multiple rivals in a dramatic last round that reshaped the VFL finals picture. The Demons burst out of the blocks with the lively Ricky Mentha Jr. heavily involved, racking up 5 early touches and a goal. Yet despite the fast start, Box Hill's class shone through as they kicked 4 unanswered goals to lead by 17 points at quarter time. From there, however, Casey's pressure and midfield dominance began to bite. Although still wasteful in front of goal, they clawed back ground with Jack Billings and Riley Bonner setting the tone through the sheer weight of possession. At halftime, Box Hill's lead had been cut to just 7 points. The game turned decisively after the main break. Tom Campbell gradually wrestled control in the ruck against Ned Reeves, allowing Casey's on-ballers Bailey Laurie, Colton Tolstrup and Kiner Brown to take full advantage. By three-quarter time, the Demons had surged to a 19-point buffer, their defence proving nearly impossible to penetrate. With Tom Fullerton intercepting everything inside and young defenders Jed Adams and Wardle Lowell providing strong support, Box Hill's avenues to goal dried up. A team-orientated forward line iced the contest. Casey's first 10 goals came from 10 different players, underscoring their even spread of contributors. Youngster Luca Kentfield was the most productive with a game-high 3 goals, while Toby Sinema, a Melbourne NGA prospect debuting at VFL level, added one of his own in an impressive second-half cameo. By the final siren, Casey had closed out the match with maturity, ensuring a triumph, 88-65. Jack Billings, 40 disposals, 7 marks, 6 tackles, 5 clearances and a goal. It was a vintage display of class and consistency. Billings was everywhere dictating play and showing his AFL experience. Riley Bonner, 40 disposals, 7 inside 50s and a goal. Complementing Billings perfectly, Bonner's ball use and composure was instrumental. His long-range goal was one of the highlights of the afternoon. Bailey Laurie, 25 disposals, 10 inside 50s and 1 goal. He was dynamic and dangerous. He was a constant threat surging forward. Colton Tolstrup, 25 disposals and 8 tackles, provided grunt and energy, helping Casey gain midfield ascendancy. Charlie Spargo, 23 disposals, 7 tackles, 1 goal and 95% efficiency. He was a tireless linksman who combined pressure with polish. Tom Fullerton, 10 marks and 6 intercepts. The defensive general who repeatedly turned away Box Hill's advances. Toby Sidema, 15 disposals and a goal, had an exciting debut that hinted at a bright future. Up forward, it was a case of shared responsibility alongside Kentfield's 3 goals. 10 other Demons hit the scoreboard, including Mentha, Jefferson, Johnson, Spargo, Cross, Bonner, Billings and Laurie. Casey's season has been anything but straightforward, from a dismal 17th place in round 8 to a heartbreaking 1-point loss to Coburg in round 15 to a stunning surge that now sees them in the top 5. The win over the previously dominant Box Hill Hawks not only showcased their resilience but confirmed that the Demons enter the finals as one of the form teams of the competition. With their depth, even spread of contributors and players like Billings and Bonner in scintillating form, Casey now looked well-placed to make a genuine impact in September. Bin Man, anything to add if you saw the game?
It was a great game to watch, really enjoyable. It's worth noting our forward line was, again, Kentfield, he had a quiet game. And how many goals? He kicked 3, though. So
3,
you know, yeah. Like, is that right up your alley? Is his quiet game kicks 3 goals? So
you hit the scoreboard, you can be as quiet as you want.
Yeah, I mean, if we're halfway through the season, it'd be a strong argument to drop JBR. Well, although JBR had a great last quarter, as I said, and he was our fourth highest rated player. So, Jefferson was playing a high half forward role almost, so half forward flanker. But it's worth noting that they had a pretty strong team, including Sam Frost was one of their key defenders. And, you know, and I forget their ruckman, but he was bigger than Tom Campbell, like massive fella. It looked to be one of those frustrating games where our inaccuracy was going to hurt us again. And we just didn't seem to, we were not taking our chances, but we were really impressive in the second half. I thought Billings was, again, really super impressive. George, if you're listening, you know, Billings has got to get back into the into the seniors. So I thought it was Colt's best game, and it was a good, you know, really probably, to be honest, the argument about people made that he should have spent more time at Casey early on this season was certainly supported by his form at Casey in the last couple of weeks, and he was really instrumental. He was also really, really hard at it, and not afraid for a bit of niggle. The Cineman, who is he looks like a total gun, the kid. I love it. Lefty, makes good decisions. He did something that it sounds easy, but it's just amazing how few of our players do it. He had the ball on the 50-meter line. He won possession, or he got it. So many of our players just dump kick that ball without thinking, but he took a beat, assessed his option in a split second. Kent Field was by himself in the pocket, but he saw him, made the right decision, and then, again, it sounds simple, but he hit the 30-metre kick, and Kent Field goes back and goals. And it was a really crucial time, as noted, as you said, he kicked an important goal, actually. Like, it was an important goal in the context of the match. He looks like a bright future. He's an NGA, so I don't really understand how it works, except the fact that we're assuming we've got the points and all of that, that we can nominate him or get him, which maybe offsets a little bit of the fact that we're giving up our first draft pick to the Bombers, which is going to not bother us now, but it will on draft night. So, yeah, he looked something to see, and really liked his kicking action, actually. Kentfield, as I said, Colt was really good. It was a really terrific win. I thought Laurie played well. There were a lot of winners on the day, and Spargo again was first class, and I could probably say we roll into the changes. I could see Spargo coming in for surely Sharp has had his, you know, another game where he hasn't really set the world on fire. Surely Spargo comes in for Sharp.
Well, let's get into the changes. There were no injuries recorded in the match against the Hawks. Tom McDonald was subbed out of the game for Jake Milsham, but as far as I'm aware, he was not subbed for an injury. He's not listed on the injury list this week. Xavier Lindsay last week presented with a hamstring soreness and was unavailable to take on the Hawks. I thought that he may come back in this week, but in the injury list today, he will not be playing. He'll be out for the remainder of the season, which is that one game. So the hamstring soreness, obviously, season. So I don't think he's available to play. He's probably played too many senior games to be able to be available for Casey, and probably not played any Casey games either. So
what's the other? Is anyone else on the injury list that's?
So we've got Casey now have a week off, so it could be possible that one or more players is given a taste of the big leagues. Oliver Seston, who had that face injury, is available on the injury list as well from Casey players. Matt Jefferson, toe, TBC, so I don't know how bad that is. Jack Henderson, groin, TBC. Lindsay's now out for the season. Windsor's out for the season. Everyone else, Lever, Hoare, McAdam, and Andy Moniz Wakefield out for the season, as we know. So,
just going backwards, Jed Adams, by the way, had a pretty poor first quarter, I thought, but he was really good after that. And so, in terms of him coming in, I don't know. Like, would you drop Chaplin? Would Chaplin drop May? Like, was it that?
It's the last game of the year. Who knows whether May could retire at the end of the year? Who knows?
I don't know what his
thoughts are. So they'll play. I don't know. I don't think that he's going to make any statements and drop someone.
No, probably not. So May will keep his spot, in which case really it's probably just the one Sharp out for I'd bring Spargo in, and I don't know. Do you know your qualifications? Do you know if Spargo's eligible to play VFL finals?
I would say so. He probably hasn't played enough senior games to disqualify him. Then the other way is how many games has he played? He's probably played enough for Casey to qualify that way.
Isn't there a minimum?
I think the only disqualifier is either you haven't played enough games for Casey or you've played too many senior games.
But how many games is it? What's the minimum number of games for Casey?
I would just be guessing, but I'll say five.
All right, let's say five. Or
ask ChatGPT. What's the chance ChatGPT knows?
It'll probably hallucinate and say Spargo to become Ruckman or something. If it's five, he hasn't played five, has he, VFL games? Or has he?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Right. Well, we're really being helpful now for our listeners.
I would say he has. I would say he's.
Well, the reason I ask is because that might go. No, it makes no difference because they're not playing this week. So bring Spargo back in, unless I don't think that will take him over the MAC. You know, any threshold for senior games. So it'll be interesting though. They could give Colt a run genuinely on the back of his best game at Casey. Spargo, two good games in a row, deserves a crack. You know, maybe it's time to ring up Bucks and say, "What do you think, Bucks? Who should we be bringing up from Casey?"
Oh, listen to this. Who knows if this is right? This is ChatGPT. Key eligibility rules for the AFL listed players in VFL finals. Minimum games required. An AFL listed player needs to have played at least one AFL or VFL senior grade, Development League match during the season to be eligible for VFL senior grade finals. So you only have to play one. We'll say that. If they've played after July 1st, if the players played in the AFL home and away match after, they must have played at least six VFL senior grade matches during the season to qualify for VFL finals. So it's six. For clubs that do not field a development league team, an AFL listed player must have played no more than 12 AFL home and away games. So if you played more than 12, I think Spargo has played six. Well, I can probably see.
I don't reckon he has played six. And just if ChatGPT is correct there, does that mean Cinema's eligible?
Didn't he just play one game?
Yeah, didn't you just say though?
But he's not an AFL listed player.
Oh, okay, right. So
maybe he can play. This is the AFL listed players. Casey Demons, Box Hill Hawks. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Ooh, Charlie Spargo's only played 5 games in 2025 for Casey.
So he can't play finals then?
No.
So put him in the seniors. Well, it wouldn't matter because they could also play the following week, I guess, unless it took them over the threshold for too many AFL games.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't played 12. All right, well, let's go into this preview. This horrendous season is almost over, at least on field, that is. We've still got a long way to go this season. Coach announcements. Does anyone want the job? What else have we got? We've got the trade period. There's going to be some players jumping ship. I'm telling you, it's going to be a messy one, I reckon. Will we be able to attract anyone to our club? Let's see who we get in as coach. But anyway, Demons now have an opportunity to rain on the Magpies parade. If the Demons beat the old enemy, they could possibly knock them out of the top four. And that would may put a massive dent in their finals campaigns, and that might be the only happy thing that comes out of this season for us. Doug Remus says, my mate calls me a tragic optimist. Sure, I talk up my pure hatred for the Pies and cling to the hope that Gorn might inspire the boys to put a dent in Collingwood's top four chances in 2025. But when I step back and look at it with a clear head, I honestly can't see it happening. So here's my question. Can you make an analytical case for how we could actually beat the filth? Do we need May to announce his retirement and come out Alistair Lynch style? Also, keep in mind, out of 42 games this year, only 3 bottom 9 teams have beaten top 9 teams. I believe we might have had 1 or 2 of those wins against the Lions and Freo. So, B-Man, make a case to how we beat these Pies.
Well, for a start, Doug Remy, you don't counteract your own argument. Like, that is a remarkable stat, and it goes to the point I made a few weeks ago, is the AFL this season has been a shocker for the AFL. So many terrible games, so many average games of footy, like just the top nine, the top bottom nine can't beat the top nine. It's hopeless. So, all right, Doug Reba, tell your filth-loving friend to put this in his pipe and smoke it. After the bye, the Pies won 3 game on end against the might of the Saints. They just got over the top by a measly 29 points against the Eagles, and then they beat the hapless Blues by 56 points. Probably the Pies fans are all up and about at that point thinking, just doing, you know, what professional teams do and winning the games. But let's face it, they beat the Saints and the Eagles and the Blues in that run. They then got beaten by, so they won three on end. They then got beaten by the Suns. They got beaten by a point, and that was a goal. They got beaten by a point by Frio, heartbreaker. Then they got had a win against another lowly bottom four team in Richmond. Got completely shellacked by Brisbane Lions, and then smashed by 64 against the Hawks. And then, despite having a 3-day, 9-day break to 6-day break against the Crows, and dominating inside 50s, lost another close one. So they've completely lost their magic about winning those close games. In fact, you know, they've dropped off a cliff in that regard. Since the bye, remembering they won the first three games since the bye, they've played 9 games and only won 4, all against all bar Carlton, who aren't that much better, against bottom four teams. So, like, really, that is not the sort of form you want to for a team that is going to be competitive going into the finals. Recently, like going back quite a long way, the history of flag winners is quite consistent that they win a really, you know, 80-90% of their last 8 or 9 games. That's a really clear pattern over a long time. It's one of the one things that hasn't really changed in terms of historical antecedents for flag winners. And the Pies, I think their fitness has dropped off a cliff. They really look like they're not running out games as well as they have done in the past. And maybe finally the huge number of older players, over 30 players, is catching up with them. I think I mentioned we were fifth for ball movement. I think actually we are fifth for the season, but the data I was actually looking at was for the last 5 games since so after round 23, and that's based on the that premiership metrics that I haven't watched the 360 or on the couch all season, but they always talk about that premiership metrics about with the footy. So territory is points for, shots at goal, inside 50 differential, points from turnover, time in forward half, chain to score, defensive 50 to inside 50, and kick retention. And then without the footy, points against, shots at oppo, shots at goal, oppo marks on lead, opposition points from turnover, post clearance contested, possession differential, opposition points from forward half, opposition chain to score, opposition defense 50. And that's that thing that they've talked about for the last few years on the couch and on 360 or whatever, about it being the premiership metric, where when you graph those things up, the premiership winners are always in the top quadrant of being, you know, ranked in the top 5 for what they do with the footy and rank in the top 5 with what they do without the footy. In the last 5 games, we are ranked 5 for what we do with the footy, which goes to my point about we're actually doing really well in that transition, the ball space. So points from turnover, chain to score, all of those things. We're ranked 5th in the last 5 weeks for that stat. The Collingwood Pies, conversely, are 12th. For what they do with the footy. So they're just not moving the ball down the ground. They're just not scoring. And, you know, as I said, their wins since the bye have been against rubbish teams. So so they're just not moving the ball. Conversely, defensively, we've been really poor. So we're ranked 10th in the AFL. Their real strength, I think, what they've done really well this year, the Pies, and what they've super improved, I think, is in their defense. In the last 5 weeks, they're ranked 5th. So it's almost exactly the opposite. So we're ranked 5th in the last 5 weeks for what we do with the footy in terms of getting territory, but 10th in our defense with what we do without the footy. And it's basically reversed for the Pies. I think that we won't be beaten for leg speed with the Pies, so that's not a same issue. They're, you know, some interesting numbers. They're way down in tackles, 14th in tackles, 14th in goal assists, it's 13th in clearances. So hopefully we won't get a touch-up like we did on the weekend from those clearance numbers, although we won the clearance rate, as I said. We're just not scores from clearances. 4th in marks per game is going to be a challenge for us. they're third in intercepts. So that's based a lot on the work of Moore, but he's been, I don't know if you've watched any of Pies games lately, he was terrible on the weekend and he was poor last week. Second for tackles inside 50 per game, that's a big one, and that's something that we've dropped off in the last 2 weeks that we've got to get back, partly because Coz has dropped off and partly because he's been playing in the middle. I think this game sets up, it's one of those neutral games where if we bring the heat right from the get-go, even if we bring the heat that we did against the Hawks, I think we're a good chance of winning this game. They're not hurting teams on transition like they used to. They're, like I just said, they're, you know, for ball movement, which isn't purely transition, but they're way off their 23 form in terms of their ability to transition from the back half. Defensively, they've got better than they were in 23 and 24. But I think we match up really well against them. They won't do us for pace. They won't be able to spread the ground. And I think their fitness is waning. So I'm actually really bullish about this game. The line is 22 points in this game, 19.5. If we keep them under that, if we can keep them and beat the line, so there's two potential wins here for Doug Reamer. So if we can, if I read on Demon Land, if we can keep them to under a 20-point win, there's every chance that they won't finish top four. And what better incentive than that? If we can beat them, then they definitely won't finish top four, almost certainly. So I reckon we're a good chance of winning this game. And I wouldn't mind betting that they've set us for it because, you know, like I just think that Eddie's right for once. It's our grand final, even though we're not getting the gate. Friday night game at the G. It's in isolation. I really think we're a good chance of winning it and upsetting the Pies apple cart.
Yes. Talag really is our grand final. All right, well,
let's... Buckley will be there. Just think about it. Think of all of the images.
Well, maybe... Maybe we don't want him watching our games. You
know, we win the game and it's all, oh, wow, this is just so synergistic with Buckley and Pies, and, you know, it's just the stories will write themselves.
Can imagine they announce it at the ground afterwards, like when they're presenting a trophy.
Yeah, like, well, you know, if we get, you know, maybe if we get three goals up with 2 minutes to go, the crowd can start chanting, Bucks, Bucks, Bucks.
I don't know. I don't think, not convinced it's going to be Bucks.
Oh, well, they have announced the have you got any views on the selection committee?
Look, what half the people are saying, oh, it's already Bucks, so why are they going with this charade? But why would they do that? Why would they, you know, why would they go along with some charade to, you know, pick a selection panel if they've already know who they're going to take?
We've still got to put the fella through his paces in front of course. The panel. Come on.
And as well, there's potential maybe assistance that come out of this process as well. So I don't know.
Totally. And going back to that question of game plan, if I was on the selection panel, that'd be one of the first questions I asked is, what's your vision for how you want to play, how you want the team to play next season? Yep. And, you know, it will be interesting. Presumably it'll still be transition, but maybe, who knows? Like, he might decide, no, I'm going to go back to a radically ultra defense style because that's what I like, how I like coaching.
I just hope that they sort of get somebody before the trade period, because we sort of, that's part and parcel of the new coach coming in needs a bit of input in that.
Yeah,
and particularly if we want to be able to entice anyone. I've heard a couple of whispers of players linked to us and don't need
it. Some whispers about players leaving too.
Well, yeah, I think there's going to be some tears from Melbourne supporters. Some favourite sons might be going.
Well, none from me, and, I mean, we'll talk about this in maybe the wrap-up, but I'd be trading Track and I'd be trading Steve May
I don't think Steve May is at the – I don't think would trade him.
I would. I'd be looking at – I mean, we won't get a huge amount for him given where, but, you know, he could thrive at a club like the Roos and we'll get something back in return for him. I think Track –
You he know, looks checked I, out to me.
Yeah.
You saw the vision last week. I don't know. I just, yeah.
Yeah. And so we've, like, when we really, realistically, as I said, last year, let's trade him last year when he was at his high watermark, because he hasn't probably improved his stock this year particularly. I mean, he's still been one of our best players, but that probably says more about how poorly we've been going.
Fairly compensated. And I know we're probably going to have to pay out some of his contract, but we've still got to get fairly compensated.
Well, I had a mate text me the other day to say, what about, I think, who did he say for Chole? And Jaith, yeah, and someon McKenzie. So I'd take that in a heartbeat.
Let's go.
Jaith, McKenzie, and I think it was McKenzie, and Jaith, McKenzie, and Chole. And, you know, I think that Chole, like, he's a bit casual, but he brings the ball to ground, and, you know, like, we do need some presence up forward, don't we? So, McKenzie, young promising midfielder, Jaith, athletic halfback flank, and Chole for track. And I said, take it in a heartbeat, bang. Where do I sign?
I think we also need some draft picks somewhere from someone.
We can trade and get future picks. We can get, you know, I think McVee's the other one that's obviously.
It sounds like he's going to go. He hasn't signed. I don't think he's close to it from what I've heard.
Hopefully we'll get a first rounder for him.
You know, I don't think we'll get a first rounder for him.
Oh, what did we get for Nibbler, for instance?
Packet of chips.
Second round. You know, yeah,
it was basically, effectively, at the end of the day, it was McAdam. It was a straight swap. Wow. Second round picks, and that's who we got. And all right.
Well, anyway.
I'm going to leave it there for tonight. We'll be back next week to break down our final game of the season, which is against the Pies. Thank you to our 5-star reviewer on Apple Podcasts. That was Cornsy. And as always, questions and comments, they do form an integral part of the show. So thank you to our Demonland posters who submitted those questions and comments. Thank you to Supreme Demon, What Say What, The Jackson Fix, D for Life, Fab Demon, Howard Grimes, Travi 14, Pitmaster, Spirit of Norm Smith, Never Odd or Even, Blue and Red, Wells 11, Doomsday D, Roastar, Doug Reamer, Buck Naked, Titan Uranus, and At the Break of Gorn. Thank you to my co-host, Bin Man, and thank you to you, our loyal listeners. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts, and we'll read it out and give you that shout-out on the show next week. Go Demons!
Go Red Leggers!